Welcome to The Learning Curve, a show about helping kids get good grades in school and succeed in life. The Learning Curve is for parents, teachers, and students, because all of life is a learning curve, and you'll succeed to the extent that you can learn easily. Now, here's your hosts, the authors of How to Learn, How to Teach, Overcoming the Seven Barriers to Comprehension, Roger and Virginia.
In today's show, we discuss the subject of multiple intelligence and its importance and what happens when the principles of multiple intelligence are tripped on or ignored in the everyday school system. Today's guest on the Learning Curve with Roger and Virginia is Jen Lilienstein. In 1994, Jen did her undergraduate senior thesis on Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligence and its effect on self-esteem, attendance rates, and love of learning. After graduation, she returned to a passion for non-traditional education. So welcome, Jen. I've got the big question here, and that is, what's the song here on multiple intelligence?
Well, multiple intelligences came out of Howard Gardner's theory. He worked with the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and his perspective on things is that when traditional IQ tests measure just acumen in logical mathematical intelligence and a little bit of spatial intelligence, and can you understand words, can you understand numbers, and can you understand a little bit of spatial stuff, perspective is that there are a myriad of different ways that kids can be smart, and not acknowledging all the different ways that the kids can be smart really does a disservice not only to the children but to our society as a whole. Because And then his other perspective that bred out of multiple intelligence is that intelligence isn't something that you get one score and that's your score forever and ever. His perspective is that intelligence is really elastic, and you can use different intelligences, the different of the eight intelligences that he defines, can use those to stretch and strengthen all of the different, your mind.
Boy, that's really brilliant. Our listeners are interested. Do you recall what the eight intelligences are offhand?
Yes, there's bodily kinesthetic, so the both fine and gross motor movement. There's interpersonal intelligence, which you and Virginia have in spades, obviously. There's intrapersonal intelligence, which is sometimes referred to as self-smart, so really having a good gauge on your emotions and how you are reacting to certain situations, and emotional intelligence is sometimes what it's called. Naturalist intelligence, which is really understanding nature and ecology
and your environment,
the ones that we know. Right, exactly. The logical mathematical, which is the ones that we generally associate with number smarts and the kids who are really good in math classes. Linguistic, which again parallels with all the kids who are good in English and, you know, that language arts side of the SATs. Then there's visual spatial, which encompasses both painting kinds of, like artwork kinds of things, but also how things fit together. So, you know, kids who are good at puzzles or kids who like to do architecture and Legos kinds of things. That's more of a visual spatial kind of intelligence. And then the eighth one is musical intelligence. These are things that in schools of old, you used to dabble in all of them across the board. And as we've gone through the last century or so, the cookie cutters and the real standardized testing-centric kind of schooling that we're moving toward, more and more of these intelligences are getting left by the by. And so that's actually what I studied, you know, 20 years ago, was looking at different schools for how many of the different intelligences were acknowledged by their school system and as well as their teachers. And then what kind of an impact that had on the kids and how smart they felt and how many different career directions they felt that they had as potentials for them and what the absence rates looked like. And I mean, I think that was the most dramatic thing, was really seeing what kind of an impact having a wide variety of classes that the kids could get excited about during the day had on those attendance rates.
Because if you validate the innate and natural abilities of a child, they blossom.
Right.
And,
exactly.
If you pigeonhole them and restrict them and effectively dumb them down into just effectively two things, boy, what a damaging exercise that has been.
Absolutely.
I was fortunate in my address to education. I was educated in Australia in the old days, like 60-odd years ago. And then as I traveled around the world, I traveled through Europe, and I was had the opportunity to run into Maria Montessori's system and the Rudolf Steiner
Waldorf
schools. And it was interesting how broadly educated and facilitated children were in those two paradigms as compared to the limited paradigm that we see now in the States. Did you get rub into the Waldorf situation at all in your investigations?
Yes, actually I did. Mm-hmm. And they were one of the ones, both the Montessori and the Waldorf curriculums were the ones that were heavier on the eight intelligences. And then at that point, public was a little bit heavier on sort of in the middle of the road. Mm-hmm. And the parochial schools were the ones actually that were narrowly focused. And I think at this point, if I went through and did it again, it would probably be a swap where the public schools were at the lower end of the continuum, and then the parochial, and then, you know, up again to the Waldorf and to the Montessori. And then, you know, there are certain kinds of charter schools that are talk about being student-centered or, you know, like an open alternative kind of program.
Right.
And some of them are multiple intelligence-based. You've kind of got the continuum going, but public schools are definitely on the lower end of the continuum these days.
It's amazing that his work has not been validated in the educational system. It's a matter of dollars, is it?
Yep, there's a lot of dollars that go into it, and there's a lot of, they're trying to compete in ways that are measurable. It's a lot easier to compete in a measurable kind of perspective when you're looking at test scores that are, you know, scanned
very
down,
limited,
filled
yeah.
out, and they're consistent across the board from what's being taught in the U.S. versus what's being taught in Europe versus what's being taught in Asia, you know, in some of the Asian countries. Mm. And so it's just a lot more quantifiable. But, you know, I mean, one of the things that I am really focused on now is all of the qualitative things that have been left by the by. I mean, some of the, you know, the impact of how a teacher that gets a student has a real qualitative positive impact on that child's success in school that year. I mean, and it goes back to what we all experienced when we were in schools. I mean, when you think back on your favorite teachers, at least if you're like most of the people that I talk to, the ones that really you felt like really got you, you were more excited about going to school in the morning to go see those teachers. You were much more willing to put in the extra effort for those teachers. And they were able to tailor and tweak their lesson plans and their approaches to certain subjects in ways that made sense to you. And so, you know, like in Gardner's multiple intelligences, you know, those are the people who are really highly on the interpersonal and intrapersonal piece of the spectrum. I mean, they're the ones with really high, sometimes it's called EQ, which is emotional intelligence.
Following his paradigm, you are developing the whole child.
Right.
And that way they become more fulfilled and enjoy the schooling process. Being limited to just writing and arithmetic, you know, English and arithmetic, and having that rammed down your throat and wondering why you're doing all this is no way to really develop a child.
Right. And, you know, I mean, and using the good contextual lenses for them. You know, I mean, a lot of times kids who didn't think that they liked math, if you start to engage them in math through music, through naturalist kinds of approaches or something that they really are interested and enthusiastic about, then all of a sudden you've sharpened their focus on something that they hadn't been as interested in through a lens that they do really like a lot. So it's sort of like putting rose-colored glasses on a child, you know, and all of a sudden they like math because they're seeing it in a different way. So it's really important for teachers, or at least in my perspective, it's really important for teachers and for parents really clued into the way what their kids are enthusiastic about and try to teach them through playing to their strengths.
So, Jen, you have a website called kidsmet.com, KIDZMET, is that correct?
That's correct, Virginia.
How did you come to that name?
It has a lot to do with Kidsmet, which is what's meant to be. And I was born out of my frustration with trying to pigeonhole these kids into, you know, such a narrowly banded path and just really feeling like, you know, these kids all have these really unique spirits, and we need to let them be who they're meant to be, and, right. and let them learn in the ways that they're meant to learn. For, as an example, for extroverts and introverts, if you've got a parent who is an introvert and is trying to teach their child or help with homework in a way that works best for them as a child, it's a completely different content digesting process for an extrovert than it is for an introvert. So the parent can really struggle with homework time, saying, I just don't know how to get through to this kid. This is what really worked for me when I was a child, but the extroverted child needs to learn through group discussions and through, you know, kind of talking over one another, and they have more of a discuss and then reflect and then discuss path toward content understanding, whereas the introverted parent, they needed to reflect first and think about things before they volunteered an answer, and so it's a completely different kind of process. That's what my main mission with KidsMet is to not only help teachers understand how students are kind of uniquely wired to learn best. I mean, it doesn't mean that they can't learn in all these different ways, but it means that they will enjoy the learning process and want to learn more and maybe get things faster if you use these certain approaches. And not only is that good for teachers, but it's also good for parents.
How would parents go about determining what their child's learning preference or learning style is?
On our site, what they do is they go through and they take what we've collapsed, what's called an inventory. There used to be different kinds of inventories for all these different kinds of learning preferences. We've collapsed three of the most prevalent ones, multiple intelligences and personality types. And we go more by the Jungian personality type, a little bit Myers-Briggs, but because we're focused on the age band that we're focused on, we're more Jungian. The AK learning style, which is another one of the most prevalent theories that's been out there. And because so many of the questions overlap with each other, we've been able to put them all into one inventory. So it's 85 questions. It takes about 15 to 20 minutes. But after that, after taking that assessment, the parents and the teachers can get a report on this is how your child stacked up. It's just a preference profile. It's not measuring aptitude at all. It's measuring enthusiasm for things so that they can really key into what's going to make learning more fun for their kids.
That's a very important point. Addressing a child's, what we could use the word, innate interests.
Right.
And develop them from there. That's the real basis, yes.
The way that you get to mastery is through motivations. You can't you can't get to mastery without the motivation. And so there's been a lot of focus on content pacing and kind of what kids know already, but there hasn't been as much focus on who they are and how they learn. And so that's what we're mainly focused on, that part of the equation.
How young would you say a parent could start using this inventory for their children? I imagine it changes over time. Is that true as well?
It does. It changes over time. I mean, we generally recommend on our site that the kids retake the assessment about once a year, because we do believe that intelligence is elastic and that preferences do shift and change a little bit. So we recommend once a year. But we're focused primarily on the age band from second grade through eighth grade, so kind of 7 to 13. That being said, I did it on my daughter when she was 4, and she was able to get through it. And a lot of the questions that she may not have been able to answer at that point for herself, you know, as a parent, you can see where she lies on that spectrum.
Right.
And it uses the SMILE scale, so it's something where it's not as misunderstood by kids as ranks us from 1 to 5. What does 1 mean? What does 5 mean? That's why we use the SMILE scale. So it's something that they can start getting insights on really young. If it's a kind of a mashup of the teacher or the parent assessment and the child assessment, and then in schools we're generally piloting it in the second through eighth grade band, because they can do it in the computer lab there.
So I guess once the assessment is done and you get the results back, you now know what the child's strengths are and how to motivate them, or what areas to use to motivate them to learn other things.
Right. You know, I mean, everything from, you know, as an example, I'm more of an introvert and my daughter is an extreme extrovert, and I'm more of a visual learner and she is more of a kinesthetic learner. So when I was trying to get her prepped for kindergarten and for first grade, some of the things that I was using as approaches weren't necessarily working, but then the information that we used in the snapshots, I started moving my approach with her over to more of a kinesthetic learning style and using some of her multiple intelligence interests and her personality type to really kind of shape the way that I was helping her, and things came so much more quickly. And I've heard that from parent after parent, because a lot of times the parents aren't as versed in, you know, how to teach as some of the teachers are. And for teachers, it's tough because they've got 30 kids in the class, and trying to get to know each of those students individually can be a real challenge.
Yeah, and so, particularly in the short time that they typically are with the students. One of the advantages of Waldorf is that the teacher moves with the students throughout their academic career.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So you really, it's almost like a family progression through the kids' development. There's advantages
right.
in that. Do you know, I saw
a
statistic.
And the age bands are wider too. So that, you know, it really helps with the ebb and flow that happens with the development of a variety of different kids.
Yeah.
Because some will accelerate at different places.
I see, Jen, that you're on the editorial board of the National After School Association.
Yes.
I'm hung up on this word after school. So what is this?
After school and actual summer learning is another component of what's generally recognized as out of school time. And one of the reasons I'm so passionate about after school is because those are opportunities during the day where the school bell has rung. A lot of times the parents are still working, so they have a choice of whether they can, you know, have their kids come home to a babysitter or whether they can enroll them in an after-school program through the campus. And one of the beautiful things about it is that in after-school, you're able to key into some of those other multiple intelligences that might not be addressed during the school day. And it's exciting for the kids because all of a sudden they're able to really key into what they're passionate about and what they feel like they're good at, and
wow,
get recognized
brilliant.
By other people within their school setting for their strengths. And one of the other benefits of it being an after-school program is that because they have to go to school in order to get into the after-school program, it also helps with attendance rates. And there's just so much more, or at least in my perspective, there's so much more creativity and that's going into these after-school programs because then the focus isn't so much on the standardized testing. So even if it might be an educational or enrichment activity that's happening after school, they've got a much wider
spectrum.
Yeah, they've got
things
a much
to address.
Better, right, and they've got a better. They're not as narrowly focused on teaching to the test, so they can kind of ebb and flow with what's good for their students at that point and really key into things and kind of it's more student-centric learning, going with the
needs and the wants of the kids, yeah.
Right. I just think in so many ways that's where love of learning is going to get inspired in school these days. There's a lot of discussion, and again, this feeds into out-of-school time, which is, you know, another component of the National After School Association. Out-of-school time also includes the summertime, and a lot of what you see in the achievement gap that happens between the end of one school year and the beginning of the next is access to summer learning opportunities. So the kids who have access to summer learning opportunities and keep learning over the summer, they start the next school year with their brain still sort of in gear and engaged, whereas it's a lot harder to sort of start that momentum up again for the kids who don't have access to those summer learning opportunities. And when you look at it, again, this is quantifiable, so it's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum than I generally concentrate on. But the narrowing of that achievement gap is also narrower when you account for other countries. The longer you can keep kids engaged in learning opportunities, and it doesn't necessarily need to mean that they're engaged in English and math. It just as long as they're continuing to learn
to work the brain
and work the brain, right? It's,
yeah,
I mean,
keep it fit.
The brain is a muscle too. So
yeah, we had a guest.
You're flexing your mind muscles.
Yeah,
I mean,
we had a guest a couple of months ago, and her specialty was exercising the brain as a muscle. Quite amazing.
Right.
It was a revelation to me. Intellectual muscle, it was called, or something like that.
Does your website have any resources there for parents, whether they want to look up after-school programs or summer programs, or do you have exercises or suggestions that parents can use?
After the assessment's completed, we have two different formats of results. One of them is called what we call a pairing portrait. And what that gives is gives kind of activities that the kids might be most interested in, what to look for and avoid in both activities and enrichment teachers. And then the opposite side of it is, so kind of that out-of-school time activity is the parent portrait, and then the during the school day and during homework activity is the student snapshot. So both are available to parents.
I see that you suggest that once a parent learns what a student's or a child's learning style is, learning preferences are, that you contact the child's school and get them assigned to the proper teacher. How? First of all, how do you know what teacher would facilitate your child, and how would you go about even having this conversation with a school official?
That's actually one of the most important things, at least in my perspective, that you can do. You know, every April and May, what starts to happen is administrators start to sit down, and counselors and teachers all start to sit down together and say, okay, here are the kids that we've got on our docket for this grade level for the next year. And they start to do sort of almost like a fantasy football kind of thing with, okay, here are what their stats look like. You know, why don't we put these guys up here? I'll trade you this player for this player. What can be a real challenge is for either kids that are just moving into the area, they're transferring schools, or for students that have had not an optimal teacher match the year prior, they can either get placed in a classroom that's not the best possible classroom for them or with not the best possible teacher for them, or they can get tagged as a behavior problem when really what it was is, from an eHarmony kind of perspective, it just wasn't a great teacher-student match. And that happens often. The ways that we think are just so different from one another. We have a couple of different ways that we like to approach it. From the parent-directed side of things, we recommend that the parent prints out that student snapshot for the administrator or emails it directly to them and says, this is how my child prefers to learn. So that you're not saying, hey, I want XYZ teacher to them. You're saying, this is what my child looks like from a learning perspective. So when you are looking to match my child with one of the five or six or seven teachers that are available in the next grade, make sure that you take this into account. Because one of the things that I think a lot of administrators bristle about is the fact that you're asking for a specific teacher. They're the favorite teachers that are out there. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to be the best teacher for your child. By giving them this kind of a snapshot, you can say, hey, this is who my child is. Four out of those teachers might work great for my child, but three of them won't. So that's just clever. Make sure that you're placing them with the right one. And then at the school level, what we do for our campus account holders, we actually have something where the teachers take the profiles as well as the students, and then we give an evaluation of the match strength.
That's clever.
What we call a fit type. Yeah, so in a lot of cases, the students will have what we call a natural fit teacher, which is someone who likes to learn in very similar ways, so it's a really easy teacher-student connection for them to make.
Yeah.
We have complement fits, which are a little bit more of a stretch. It's still going to be something that you can work with as a teacher, but you need to make sure that you are acknowledging the different ways in which that child likes to learn. And then we have what's called a growth fit, and those growth fits are what we recommend to school administrators and to grade-level teams. Whatever you do, try and avoid those growth fits, because they like to learn in such different ways, and it's going to be an uncomfortable year not only for the students, but it's also going to be an uncomfortable year for the teacher, because system is frustrating when a student can't learn for the students. It's equally frustrating for this teacher who's dedicated their life to teaching kids and just can't get through to that student. So if you can avoid those kinds of matchups and focus in on the ones that are natural and complement fits, it's going to be a more exciting year for the class as a whole, for students in that class, and for the teacher.
As you were speaking, something came to mind for me, and that was my fourth grade teacher. And it brought to mind that, well, first of all, we were not a match, that is for sure. It was probably the worst time I had ever had in school. And thinking back, if I can remember her, her face was very sour. That's the one thing I do remember. I don't think I've ever seen her smile. And she was an elderly lady. And I think she was simply hanging in there to reach her retirement age. And she was just simply going to do the minimum amount of work and just manage to get through the day. Suppose your child gets somebody like that.
that's actually one of the reasons that it's really important for parents to key into their kids' learning preferences, because you are going to end up with some of those teacher-student matchups. It's something where if you end up with one of those and there's something that you can do at the beginning of the year with the administrator, it's not necessarily the ideal time for them, but you know, if you can get it accomplished in April or May and say, this is who my child is, so that you have a better chance of avoiding those matchups, that's definitely what you should do. But if you end up in that scenario, there are two different things that can happen. You can either go in and talk with the administrator and use that student snapshot as a guide to say, this is how my child likes to learn. They're really not thriving in X's classroom. What do you suggest? Is there a different classes you can place them in? Because you're not going in and saying,
bad,
you know,
teaching,
I really wish I had Mrs. Smith instead. Can we put her in Mrs. Smith's class? We're saying she's just not functioning well in Mr. Jones's class. Here's who she is. Where can we go? And then the opposite side of that is that, you know, I mean, in the same way that schools are getting called to do more of the raising our kids as well as educating our kids in the current public school situation that we're in, that same thing has to happen with the parents. They have to have the dual role of not only raising your kids, but also helping to educate them.
Jen, I've got a question here. I notice on your blog, which is kidsmet.com/blog, you raise an interesting point that I'd like to discuss with you. And the question you ask as a headline is, have U.S. students fallen victim to a self-fulfilling prophecy? So what's going on there in your observation?
I feel really strongly that all of the, what I consider teaching to the test and almost over-testing is really negatively impacting our students. You know, I mean, we may be able to quantify where we stand vis-a-vis other nations at this point, but what happens to kids when you categorize them as an X percentile or, you know, where they fall on that spectrum, they start to feel like...
stigmatized,
I'm not
at least.
Right, I'm not smart. And then the next year it happens again. Yeah. I'm not smart again. And then the next year it happens again. And it's that same kind of thing where, at least when I was a kid, we didn't have all the standardized testing that happened every single year. It was more, you know, when you got to your SATs and your PSATs, you took them and then you got a score. And that really negatively impacted a lot of kids when they got their score back and they felt like they were put in a box. Well, we're starting to do that in second grade with our kids. And it's giving them every year. Every year that same kind of thing is happening. And it can just be such a defeating...
The apparency of the dumbness, which really isn't the case.
Right, exactly. I mean, and they might be smart in a completely different way, but if they're feeling like they're not smart altogether, I mean, they're not...
And all the time.
And they're not being valued for their contributions, and then it's happening year after year after year.
Yeah, we're killing them off. So the other thing I got my attention on, Jen, is I see that you're a proud recipient of the Parent Tested, Parent Approved Award. How would you like to explain that to our listeners? Because that should be something that they ought to be interested in.
That's actually something that we are extremely proud of at Kidsmet, because the Parent Tested, Parent Approved Award seal is one of the most respected, or is the most respected award seal in all of North America. And it comes from third-party parent testers. You have to put your product or service through the paces. And so in order to win that seal, we had to have a variety of different parents who had, you know, kind of no compensation for it at all, take our assessment and see if it worked. To win that award feels really good for us as an organization, you know, because in addition to the testimonials that kind of come out of the blue, coming in from parents saying, oh, this is so great, my profile was right on, it's a big batch of testers that went through and said, did this work for my child? And in order to win it, you have to have them say, yes, it did.
That's quite brilliant. It's almost like one of these great big academic studies carried out on a sort of informal basis in the real world to demonstrate that it actually does work.
So we were really proud. We're really, really proud to have won that award.
So that was your procedure for ascertaining, you know, the various intelligence faculties and abilities of the child.
It all sounds great in theory, but does it actually work? And that seal shows that it does.
So the assessment is a proven winner. Jen, it's been a delight chatting with you. It's been a bit of an eye-opener to me. So I thank you, honestly, for being here with us today and for our listeners.
Thank you so much.
Tell us your websites, because I'd like folks to be able to get onto them and benefit from what it is that you're making available.
Our website is kidsmit.com, which is spelled K-I, D as in dog, Z as in zebra, M as in Mary, E, T as in Tom.com. So kidsmit.com.
Blog is pretty much the same thing with blog tacked on the end of it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Jen, thanks very, very much.
Thank you so much for your time today.
We'll work out another session for this with a lot more questions for our audience.
Thanks for listening to The Learning Curve with Roger and Virginia. For more information on the subjects covered during the show, visit howtolearneasily.com or send an email to questions@howtolearneasily.com.